Elizabeth Elliot is a name that many people are familiar with, some in this room even. Elizabeth Elliot, her first husband Jim, and four of his comrades in arms flew to Ecuador to evangelize the people, to bring the gospel to them. And there on a beach, they were killed for their faith. And Elizabeth Elliot mourned the death of the one she loved. Several years later, she married a man named Addison Leach, who was a professor of New Testament at Gordon-Conwell University. And in 4 years, he also died. Now, Elizabeth Elliot's a person that's already familiar with death, already familiar with loss, already familiar with devastation and all the disorientation that comes with something like that. But when her second husband died, it was as if the whole tearing off of a scab was new. It was as if the whole world had become disoriented for her again. And I'm told that in the wake of losing her second husband, she did something a little different. She reached for whatever she could that would not change to stabilize her in this season where it felt like the whole world had changed all over again. And in the wake of that loss, she began to meditate upon the Apostles' Creed. She began to take that text that we cited this morning, that fourth century, the earliest distillation of what the early church had everywhere and always believed. She began just to sit with that and thought on that and considered that and meditated upon it. Brothers and sisters, when you get dizzy or when the ground beneath your feet begins to quake, what do? You reach for the nearest fixed, sturdy object. And for her, in that moment, the creed was that fixed, sturdy object. Those ideas, those truths that had not changed for millennia because they were grounded in things that were eternal. What she did in the wake of that loss is what we're going to do from now until Lent. We're going to give our attention to that fixed, sturdy object called the Apostles' Creed for the next 7 or 8 weeks. Because we believe, as she believed, that there is something to be found in giving our attention to what are the elements of our faith, the most basic contours and dimensions of what it means to be a follower of Jesus. Nothing that she meditated upon was new to her. But she realized that what you know, you still have to learn how to know all over again on a regular occasion. That's what we're going to do. And this morning, we're going to begin by just looking at the first two words of the creed. We believe. The content of the creed is the basis for our stability that we're out to seek. But what good is understanding that concept unless we know what it is to grapple with and wrestle with and grasp that content? What does it mean to come to believe? That's our focus this morning as we begin this new series. We're going to listen to two very familiar texts about faith, about belief, and we're going to try to learn three things about it: what faith is, what faith does, what faith needs. What it is, what it does, what it needs. We're going to start in the very famous passage in Hebrews chapter 11. If you'll stand, we'll start there. Hebrews chapter 11, starting in verse 1. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it, the people of old received their commendation. And then in verse 6, and without faith, it's impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. And then in Romans chapter 10, verses 9 and 10. Because if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you'll be saved. For with the heart one believes and is justified, and with the mouth one confesses and is saved. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. If you're going to talk about faith, if you're going to talk about belief, and we're going to use those two things interchangeably, although some might argue that those two words aren't perfectly synonymous, the danger in getting into a discussion about this is to let it sort of devolve into a cool, dispassionate discussion of analytical philosophy. That's not what we're going to do, because the author of Hebrews is not on the lecture circuit. He's not waxing analytical when he starts talking about faith. He's addressing a people who are under duress. There are people who have come to think and believe that Jesus is in fact Lord, and now, through a set of circumstances that they didn't anticipate, they're beginning to rethink that choice because it's cost them. They've started to become marginalized. They've started to become disenfranchised for their belief. And now they're getting their stuff stolen, they're getting mocked, they're getting their houses burned, they're getting persecuted. And so they're beginning to think, I'm not sure I'm in for this for the long haul. That's who he's talking to. That's who he's wanting to try to explain what faith is, what it does, and what it needs. And that's why he says there in verse 1, here's what faith is. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. The word, therefore, assurance is the Greek word hypostasis. And the author of Hebrews uses that Greek word in two other places in his letter. In Hebrews chapter 3, he tells them to hold fast to their confidence, their hypostasis. But he also uses that same word in the very first paragraph of his whole letter, when he says that Jesus is the exact imprint of God's nature. Hypostasis. All right. What's with the little Greek 101 lesson? In either variation of that use of the word hypostasis, sometimes it's referred to as confidence. Sometimes it's referred to as nature or substance. It kind of gives you two senses of what faith is. If it's a matter of conviction, then we're talking about faith as an inner disposition, something inwardly at work in you. But if we're talking about faith as a substance, it's something concrete, then we're talking about something that's an outward manifestation of that inward disposition. So there's two senses in which faith is operative, an inner disposition and an outward manifestation. That's what faith is, kind of. But what here Hebrews is saying in chapter 11, verses 1 and 2, is that whether we're talking about an inner disposition or an outward manifestation, they are both based on realities that are not fully realized. Ideas that are not yet seen in full. And so, if you want to think about faith, it is a gross oversimplification and perhaps the most crude illustration you can imagine. But you know what faith is? If you want to catch a bus, you wait for the bus at the stop. You don't sit at the greasy spoon nursing your kolache and your burned over coffee. You go to the spot where people are waiting, where there's a bench, where there's a nice little overhang and there's a little schedule. Because you think the bus is coming. That's waiting for the bus. That's belief. Bus ain't there yet. You can't hear it. You can't see it. You can't smell it. But you think it's coming. And so you go to the stop. That's belief. Now, again, we're always in danger of talking about belief as if it's sort of this philosophical idea. It's not. And that's why the author of Hebrews doesn't go very far before he starts unpacking the nature of faith by illustrating it through scads of different people from the Old Testament. We could read all of Hebrews 11 and we'd be done. We don't have time for that. I'm going to excerpt it. Who does he talk about? He talks about Noah. What Noah was doing? Unpopular. Undertaking a task whose outcome was rather improbable. But what trumped it was his desire to fulfill the call to build the boat. Belief. The author of Hebrews talks about Abraham. He was comfortable at home in the Ur of the Chaldeans. But when he heard the call to go, he left. He relocated. That trumped his desire to preserve the familiarities, the comforts of home. The author of Hebrews talks about Moses, who earns a reputation and all of the perks that come with being and serving in Pharaoh's court. But Moses instead chooses to identify with his people who are enslaved. That trumps whatever preferences he might have had by retaining the reputation as the one who was the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And in that long litany of faces and illustrations and stories that the author of Hebrews marshals to give us a picture of what faith and belief is, he says, here's the crowning glory of them all. They all had their hope set on a promise that they lived for and longed for even as they stepped into the grave with it yet unfulfilled. That's belief. Those are old stories. Let me tell you a few new stories you might not have caught recently. You know, John Glenn, I'm a big space buff, and you know that he died at the age of 85, I think, a couple weeks ago. Among the Mercury 7, so it is told by Tom Wolfe, who wrote The Right Stuff, that among the Mercury 7, John Glenn's the only one that even spoke of a faith in God and was entirely unequivocal about saying, you know what? I believe God has given us certain gifts, and if we use those well, He will honor us with what we've used, with what He's given us. It's belief. He didn't care that he was mocked among his comrades. He didn't care that everybody at NASA looked at him like, oh Lord, would you shut him up? That's John Glenn's story of faith. Basuki Kahaya Porjama. Not a name you probably have pronounced these days or heard of. You know who he is? He's the governor of Jakarta, Indonesia. Indonesia is the largest country of Muslims. And he is the governor of that capital city, which has anywhere from 10 to 30 million people in it. This man is a Christian. And there were many in the ruling council who thought him unfit to serve because he's not a Muslim. Here's a guy who was intolerant about corruption, who had a reputation for acting with great care, with great honor, with great integrity, and he was elected to the governorship. You know what he could have done? He could have said, you know, that whole belief in Jesus, that's really marginal to my life. I really don't want to talk about it. He doesn't. He doesn't wear it on his sleeve, but nor does he hide it. It's his belief. It's his faith. Henry Nouwen, the late Catholic priest, whose birthday was celebrated recently. Here's a man who was on a tenure track at Harvard Divinity School of Theology. He leaves that post to become a counselor to mentally handicapped people at a place called L'Arche. Oh, there are many things about Henry Nouwen's story that we might tell that demonstrate a picture of faith. But there is a picture of faith. What do all of these things have in common? Whether it's in the Old Testament or in 21st century Western civilization and Eastern civilization. What do they all have in common? In every one of those stories, there's a longing based on a promise that shapes a certain present concern. So here's what faith is. Faith is at bottom an interpretive act. You think of it as a mystical thing, right? You think of it as there's people with faith because they got the gift and there's people without it because they don't. Brothers and sisters, faith is nothing more than an interpretive act whereby you are letting future promises shape past reflections and present concerns. That's what faith is. You're letting promises about the future weigh in and have authority about your moment and even about how you conceive of all your prior moments. That's what faith is. And faith, let's just be really clear, is not constrained or confined to the religious domain. If you're in kindergarten and you strike up a conversation with somebody that might become a friend, brothers and sisters, that's faith. If you're a refugee leaving the only country you know as home and trying to make your way in a world that you know nothing about, that's faith. If you ask a girl out on a date or propose to them in that order, that's faith. You don't know what's going to happen. James Baldwin, a poet, once a preacher, civil rights activist, he says, "I am not a pessimist because I am alive." You know what he means by that? As long as he had breath in his lungs, as long as he could see the light of day, there was hope. You know why? That's faith. And that's why it's the theologian Stephen Colbert who said recently on an interview with John Dickerson on Face the Nation, he said, "You know what belief is? Belief is not a prop. Belief is a lens. It is an interpretive grid through which you view and understand everything else in your world." Yes, faith in some ways betrays a certain mystical quality to it. But you know what? It is nothing more simple and nothing more mundane than an act of interpretation whereby you allow certain ideas, certain promises to shape the way you think about present circumstances. That's what faith is. And when you see faith as that interpretive act, it actually can be a source of stability in your world. That's what faith is. Let's talk about what faith does. I'm going to think about what faith does in two senses that Hebrews speaks of. In the sense of what action it takes, like what it's up to, but then also in what consequence it has. So let's talk about those in sequence. Faith is, you know, a noun, right? But I think we'd all agree that faith is in its essence a verb. It's something that it does. Faith is as faith does. So what is faith doing? Faith is seeking God as God in all things. Faith is seeking God as God in all things. All right, talk about a mystical phrase. What does that mean? In verse 6, when he says, "Without faith it's impossible to please God, for anyone who would draw near to God," full stop. Draw near. That's a word that shows up in a lot of times in the New Testament. It shows up a number of times in the author book of the book of Hebrews. What it means is an approach. But it's not like approaching an intersection in order to pull through that intersection. It is an approach with a view to connecting, with a view to communing. And so faith, in terms of drawing near, is not this idea of placating God with your obedience. It's not this idea of impressing Him with your sacrifices. It is, in fact, an effort to seek Him in order to know Him so that His pleasure becomes your pleasure. That's what faith does, to seek Him in order to know Him. Because look, if all things are from God and by God and through God and for God, then what faith does is seeking Him in all things to see how all things fit with Him, in Him. I heard a quote recently from somebody whose name I cannot remember, but he said this. He said, "The line between faith and politics was not so much discovered as it was invented." Say that again. The line between faith and politics was not so much discovered as it was invented. What does he mean by that? That there's no such thing as a non-religious sensibility in social, economic, and geopolitical policy. Anybody that's involved in politics is also involved in religion. Because everybody brings a framework to those kinds of questions. A framework that is independent of anybody's just opinion. It appeals to some sort of transcendent idea by which we make certain decisions so that we enact certain policies. In other words, there is no line between faith and politics. They go together. Every world is a theocracy, even if they would repudiate the whole very idea of God. All right, great. So none of us are policymakers. How does that notion fit into your world? I'll tell you. Because what is true of politics is also true of any human activity. How you treat your spouse has to do with what you think about God. How you pay your taxes has to do with what you believe about God. How you take care of your body has to do with what you believe about God. God applies everywhere. Faith, therefore, what it's doing is to seek the, if you will, godness beneath everything that is. How God applies there. I'm not talking about pantheism, where we so associate God with the stool or the tree that if you chop down the tree, you're chopping down God. No, that's pantheism. It's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a belief that you look for how this is to be understood in view of God. That's what faith does. It tries to seek God as God in all things. And to ask how God fits is to seek Him as He's meant to be sought. Now that presupposes two things in the world of the author of Hebrews. He says anybody that would draw near to God must first believe that He exists. And so to quote somebody that we've quoted recently and we quote often, the Eastern Orthodox theologian David Bentley Hart, he says this: God is the most obvious thing in all of the universe. The most obvious thing in all of the universe. Let me explain that. In a book he wrote, he says, imagine somebody walking through a forest on a lovely walk. And in that walk, in the forest, in the middle of the forest, he comes upon this large translucent globe. And he thinks to himself, how in the world did that get here? He doesn't see any cranes around that would have dropped it there. He doesn't hear any civilization that would have brought it in here. He doesn't see any footprints around this thing. There's just this large translucent globe in the middle of the forest. You know what he can't do when he sees that thing, as bizarre as that image would be? He can't say, well, you know, it's just here and there's no explanation for it. You can't do that. Why he tells that story is because the experience of a man happening upon a large translucent globe in the middle of the forest should be the same way that you and I think about the existence of anything. That anything is here. For us to imagine that anything is here, you have to ask yourself, how in the world? How in the world did it get here? You can't just say, you know what? It's just here and there's no explanation for it. Now, is that a proof of God's existence? Of course not. And he doesn't assume that it is either. But he does say this. The physical order confronts us at every moment with its fortuity, meaning the fact that it's here at all is amazing. Everything about the world that seems so unexceptional and drearily predictable is in fact charged with an immense and imponderable mystery. How odd it is, how unfathomable that anything at all exists. You take it for granted, but you can't, because God is the most obvious thing in the world. And you have to presuppose that if you're going to draw near to Him in faith. The other thing you have to presuppose is this: that there's benefit to seeking Him on His terms. And that's why the author of Hebrews says, anyone who would draw near to God must believe that He exists and that He rewards those who earnestly seek Him. He rewards those who earnestly seek Him. Now, Christians in particular get ambivalent when they hear stuff like that, because they think, wait a minute, I didn't think I could do anything that would tip God's hand to show me favor. Such that when they come across a psalm like Psalm 18, where it says this: "The Lord dealt with me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands. He rewarded me, for I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not wickedly departed from my God." And particularly Christians, they hear a text like that and they think to themselves, "Hey, don't talk like that. Don't stop it. It's too haughty, dude. You got nothing before God. Why are you talking like that?" Brothers and sisters, yes, it is true. We have nothing apart from the grace of God. But you know what's also true? We are able, by our faith, to elicit His blessing. That the reward for trust is not a fiction, it's a fact. With faith comes reward. And that hints at the other part of what faith does. We've talked about the action of faith, what it's up to, what it's doing. But now let me talk to you about faith in terms of what comes of it, what follows from it. Next to the word faith in Hebrews 11, the word that gets the most airtime is the word commendation. Commend. It shows up 5 times just in chapter 11. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things unseen, he says in verse 1. And then in verse 2, he says, "For by it the people of old received their commendation." The word there, commend, is the Greek word from the cognate martyreo, which should sound familiar because it's where we get our word martyr. If any of you have seen Scorsese's latest film, Silence, which I would love to be able to organize a CTK film night some night that we might go screen it in the next few weeks. What is it talking about? The Christians in Japan who were martyrs and the Portuguese missionaries who went to support them in their martyrdom. To be a martyr was one which came to be associated with dying for your faith. So in between Christmas and Epiphany, what is it? The Feast of the Innocents, the Feast of the Martyrs, the Feast of St. Stephen. What is a martyr? One who bears witness to the worth of God in their death. Why does the author of Hebrews involve that Greek word to speak of commendation? He's using it because it's in their dying that they manifested their faith in the worth of God. But because of their faith, God is returning the affirmation. His commendation is His testimony of their honor to Him for how they've shown Him honor. And so what is faith doing? What follows from faith? Faith elicits the affirmation, the commendation of God. And that's why it says in verse 5 of Enoch that when he was commended, it was because he had come to please God by his faith. And that's why in verse 6 it says, without faith, it's impossible to please God. And so faith prompts a testimony by God of God's pleasure in their faith. Look, let me put it in the simplest terms. If you're a teacher and your kids start to get it and they start to show that they understand, you are celebrating the fact that they're getting it, but you're also inwardly celebrating the fact that they trusted you enough to listen. It's the same way with your parents. They love that you're finally listening to them, but they're also loving that you're finally trusted them enough that you are listening to them. That's belief. Now, we got to pause here a minute because let's be clear here. It sounds like there's a sequence of events here involved. There's a cause and effect sequence that you might infer from this idea that those who have faith please God. And therefore, you might infer erroneously that God is only pleased until after you've demonstrated faith. What else do we know about Scripture that might nuance our understanding of that apparent sequence? Brothers and sisters, when did Israel have God's ear and eye and attention and affection? Was it after they showed trust in Him or was it before? It was before. And that's why in Deuteronomy 7:7, it says, "It was not because you were more in number than any other people that God set His love on you." It was not something intrinsic to them, not something intrinsic to their character that would lead him to set his love upon them. It was something intrinsic to his character. Brothers and sisters, let me ask you another rhetorical question. When is it that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son? Was it after they had come to believe that God, that Jesus was God's only begotten son, or was it before? It was before. His love for those who would love him back came first. His love was prior. He loved before he gave, and then he gave in love. And so the pleasure of God both precedes our faith and proceeds from our faith. So yes, faith is essential to pleasing God, to enjoying God. But no, that does not mean that God would not show us his favor until after we showed us his faith, our faith. So rather than thinking of faith as a means by which we obtain his favor, I think it's best to think of faith as the means by which we inhabit his pleasure. He is pleased to show us grace, to bring us to him, but he's also pleased to see us respond to that grace by our faith in him. So if you want to think of this whole thing as like a building, God was pleased to build a place, a space in which we might live and breathe and have our being. To build that place. He was pleased to do it, but he is also pleased for us to dwell within that space. Especially this week, when it's 18 degrees outside, you never realize how lovely it is to have four walls and a roof over you with insulation. Because in that house, there is provision, there is protection, there is communion, and there is warmth. And it sure beats being outside. God is pleased to build you that warm house of provision, but he is also pleased for you to have the sense enough to stay inside. That's what faith does. It elicits the commendation of God, the consequence. But all that is lovely and interesting and yet hopelessly grounded in abstraction. We need something to impel us to faith. What does faith need, given what it is, given what it does? When Paul in Romans 10 speaks of his longing for his fellow Jews to trust and see Jesus as he sees Jesus, he is not just longing that they would see him as they would see him as he sees him. He's also lamenting their hubris. He's lamenting just how confident they are in their ability to win and keep God's heart. And so in Kevin's sermon last week, he reminded us all that there is no grace without us admitting our weakness. To believe in God is to concede your own weakness. For Jesus to appear, to live, and to die is to confirm just how weak we are. And only by acknowledging that weakness can you receive the gift that he's come to give. And so what faith needs is an object worthy of its placement. It needs an object worthy of its trust. And so Paul says in verse 9, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, Paul is placing before us Jesus as that object worthy of our trust. Because to call him Lord is to ascribe an authority to him. And to circle back to what we've already said, brothers and sisters, you will not interpret your past failures or your present fears as something that will not hold you in enslavement unless you believe that there are promises worthy of your trust. And Jesus gives us reasons for why those promises are worthy of your trust. You will not seek God as God and seek the commendation of God by making sacrifices that are congruent with faith unless you have good reason to believe that those promises are trustworthy. And in Jesus, you have reasons to believe that those promises are trustworthy. Because in Jesus, you are confirmed of your weakness. But when Jesus confirms you in your weakness, He is not berating you or belittling you for it. It is not Jesus who ever looks at you and says, "I find your lack of faith disturbing." That's Darth Vader, not Jesus. In Jesus, we have a confirmation of our weakness, but He doesn't berate us or belittle us for it. And in Jesus, we have a picture and a life and a story of power and of hope and of resurrection. And in doing so, that makes a compelling case for walking as He does. And while we're on the topic of Star Wars for just a moment, you know what Carrie Fisher said late in her life? Poor Carrie Fisher. She said, "What have I learned? That you should be kind. Don't hurt other people. It's all the sort of Christian ethics stuff that I used to think was nonsense when I was a kid. No, it turns out it's not nonsense. So tell the truth, be kind, all that corny stuff." Jesus gives us a picture of why that is compelling, why it's not corny, why it's not nonsense. But an ethic is on its face is nothing compared to the story of one who embodies it. And in Jesus, we have that story. He embodied what we want to be, but what we find so hard to be. In Jesus, we have a reason to embrace what faith is and what faith does. And we find in Jesus what we need, and with the help from His Spirit, to be able to find a kind of stability when all of our world becomes unstable. Brothers and sisters, what do we do with all that? If that's what faith is and what faith does and what does it need, then how then shall we live in light of what faith is all about? I'll leave you with this one story. Andrew Clavin is a murder mystery writer. I'm reading a book of his called Werewolf Cop. He grew up to Jewish parents. And in time, in his 20s and 30s, he began to think about Jesus, to read the Bible, especially the New Testament. But he had a certain aversion, a certain visceral aversion to the very idea of faith, because in his mind and in his words, he says, "Faith is the death of thought," he believed. "I don't want everything to do with faith, because it means that you check your brain at the door, that you stop thinking in order to believe." That was his belief. But what he came to discover was that faith is not the death of thought. It is actually an inducement to thought. It is an encouragement to thought. And so later in his life, he began to concede that maybe Jesus is in fact Lord, because he came to believe on account of having to come in to think. How do you apply everything that we've just talked about? For the next 7 weeks, we're going to consider seven different tenets of the Apostles' Creed. And each one of those has to do with the promise of our faith. But you know what's also true when you listen to those promises? There might be a voice in the back of your head that says, "Yeah, but..." fill in the blank. That there's a premise that you have. Maybe it's conscious. Maybe it's unconscious. That when you hear about that promise, you go, "Ah, yeah, but..." Brothers and sisters, can I invite you over the next 7 or 8 weeks to think about two things? The promises of God as it's conveyed in the Creed, and the premises that you put forth that sometimes make you think, "I don't know if I can trust that." And then I'd like you to think about both and to ask yourself, how does that promise confront those premises? Because if Andrew Clavin realized that faith is an invitation to thinking, if Elizabeth Elliot realized that in the wake of loss, that the Apostles' Creed is an invitation to thinking and meditating, if the author of Hebrews says at the end of chapter 11 to consider Jesus, the word "consider" means to think on it, then maybe you and I would do well to think long and hard about both the promises that we find in the creed and the premises that that creed confronts. Maybe then we might start to make progress in what it means to believe. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.